Do you have Ecclesiastes 3 open in front of you? Often people read this passage in Ecclesiastes 3 as evoking a very positive view of life, kind of a sense of oneness with the universe. And of course, it's beautiful poetry, and songs have been written about it. The Birds in the 60s, 70s sang this song, Turn, 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 is it? That's right. And Kennedy, President Kennedy, quoted this in a speech shortly before he died. But the reality of what we see in this passage is life under the sun. It's life under judgment. For that is what life under the sun is. It's living in a fallen world that is under the judgment of God. And strikingly, throughout this passage, we see in effect a God who is set against us. You can't help but notice, you look through the passage, it's full of what God does. Doesn't enable us to fathom his purposes in verse 11. We're to fear him, verse 14. He will bring judgment, verse 17. He will test us, verse 18. And the reason for this is so that we might know our place as those under the sun. Happens to us all, doesn't it? Comes a time when we have to learn our place. Kids get too big for their britches, and you kind of have to help them to see their rightful place in the family or in school life. You know, they think they're brilliant at football, and you have to try and help them to see that actually you're not messy, they think they're brilliant at something, and actually you have to help them to begin to see that they're not quite as good as they think they are. It happens to us as well, isn't it? We've all had to be humbled. We think we're so great, or we think we've got it sorted, and we realize we haven't. We have to learn our place. And that's what's happening in this passage. We begin to see our place as those under the sun. And so the first thing it says, so know your place. God is in charge of time, not you. God's in charge of time, not you, verses 1 to 15. See, we think we're in control. But the reality is we're not. We're caught in the tyranny of time, as one commentator puts it, the rhythm of life, verse 1. So there is a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven. So there's a time to be born and a time to die. We have no choice about these things. There's a time to plant and a time to uproot. And if you plant in the wrong season, nothing grows. And if you uproot too early or too late, then the crop is ruined. There's a time to kill and there's a time to heal. And the word kill here is not the idea of murder, it's more the idea of capital punishment. And so there's a time for capital punishment and there's time to heal and to restore relationship. There's a time to tear down and demolish and a time to build. There's a time to weep and there's time to laugh and mourn and dance. And you only have to look at family life to see that, don't you? One month you're grieving the loss of a grandparent or a parent. The next you're celebrating the birth of a grandchild or the marriage of a daughter. There's a time to scatter stones, time to gather them in. And the idea here refers to where stones are scattered over a difficult neighbor's field in order to hinder him from plowing. And then you go out and you retrieve those stones, implying an act of sorrow and repentance. Aye, there's a time to punish and a time to repent. There's a time to embrace, and there's a time to refrain from embracing. And some of us need to learn that. And there's a time to comfort, and there's a time to speak hard truths. There's a time to search for things, and there's a time to give up to know that it's a lost cause. There's a time to keep things, and there's a time to throw away. There's a time to tear, and a time to mend. There's a time to be silent, and there's a time to speak. There's a time for love, and a time for hate. There's a time for war, and there's a time for peace. And the thing that is striking as you read these verses is not the detail so much. It's the rhythm. It's the way in which it deliberately set out to make us feel that rhythm, that cyclical nature of life. So you get up, a time to born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to root, time to kill, time to heal, a time to tear down, time to build up, time to weep, time to laugh, time to mourn, time to dance, etc. That's life. Both for the believer and the non-believer, that's life under judgment. It's constrained by routine and season. It's been said that there's four seasons in a man's life. The first, when he believes in Father Christmas. Then there's a time when he no longer believes in Father Christmas. Then there's a time when he is Father Christmas. And then there's a time when he looks like Father Christmas. You can't avoid seasons and routines. Our lives are made up of them. And in fact, Solomon's already alluded to it, didn't he? We saw it back in chapter 1, verse 9, that routine of life. Remember, we get up, we feed the kids, we take them to school, we go to work, we leave work, you pick up the kids. The whole thing starts again. And our lives are just made up of numerous little cycles. So you do the cleaning, dirty the house. You do the cleaning, you dirty the house. You do the cleaning, you dirty the house. You know, you mow the lawn, you dig up the weeds. Dig up the weeds, you leave it a week. You mow the lawn, you dig up the weeds, you leave it a week. It just keeps going, doesn't it? It's just continuous. And thus the teacher writes, verse 9, what does the worker gain from his toil? And the answer is nothing. Because you have to do it all over again. And so he can write, verse 10, I've seen the burden God has laid on man. The reality of living in a world under judgment is that it is monotonous and tyrannous. That's the burden. It's part of God's judgment against us. And you see it every day. And you see people's reaction to it every day. So people hit their 40s and they want a career change and they go from being a lawyer to running their own surf shop. Because they want to break the change from the monotony. Sadly, you see the same in marriages. Couples married for 20 years and suddenly they decide to divorce. And not because of anything in particular has happened, but because they're bored. Bored with what they see as the same old routine, and so they perceive that a breakup is the change they need. That's why people yearn to win the lottery. Because they want to be free from what they see as the dull routine of life. And yet in all those circumstances, once the novelty of the change has worn off, routine and the rhythm of life just kicks right back in again. That's the burden that God has laid on men. Now, it was never meant to be this way, verse 11. God has made everything beautiful in its time. Time is created. And just as when God finished creating, he stepped back, and Genesis 1, verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good, including time. See, time was never meant to be burdensome. The routines and the seasons were all meant to be a good thing for us to enjoy. But in a world that is under judgment, these things are marred and become burdens. And added to that burden is that realization of eternity that God has set in our hearts, verse 11. And yet we cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. You see, we know there is much more than just what we see and experience, but we cannot fathom it. It's as if we're standing very close to a giant tapestry and all you can see is the very square in front. It's only when you step back do you see the whole big picture. But as those under judgment, we can't see that big picture. Which leaves us often with just a sense of frustration and angst. See, the teacher has shown us the limits of being human. That in effect we're in a giant hamster wheel that just keeps on going round and round and we cannot understand what is going on. That's life under judgment. And in one sense, it's encouraging to know this, that the wisest man, bar Jesus, researched life and discovered that this is reality for all. So we should expect to be frustrated by it at times. That's life. We should expect to feel the burden and annoyance at having to keep going through the same old thing day in, day out. That's life. Both for the believer and for the non-believer. And the most we can do, the teacher says, is, verse 12, be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all its toil. This is a gift from God. All we can do is enjoy the now. And even that, says the teacher, is dependent on God. And the contrast is then set up between God and us. All we can do is enjoy the now. God, however, is eternal. And all he does, verse 14, endures forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. He sees the big picture. He knows the beginning and the end. He is in control. Our place is not that of the one who controls time, but as those who are controlled by time. And the dawning realization is that God has set time against us. He's made it a burden for us. He's the one who has allowed us to be caught up in the hamster wheel of life. More than that, it's God who controls the seasons, the ebbs and flows of life. So he allows us to go through the good times. He allows us to go through the bad times. He determines the times of weeping. He determines the times of laughing. He determines the times of mourning. He determines the times of dancing. He determines when I get cancer and if I can have children. He determines when I get married and he determines if I don't. And the truth is, we cannot fathom why these things happen when they do or why they don't. Because we do not control time. God does. And the reason why God allows this burden to be upon us is so that, verse 14, we will revere him. That is, we will fear him. To fear God is not to be scared in the way we may fear evil men, but that we will know our place before the one who controls time. See, God's intention of setting time against us is to humble us. The problem of humanity is that we think we're in control. We think we control time, but the daily reality of life shows we don't. There's all much today, isn't there, about time management and books on how to make the most of time. And at the end of the day, all it can do is help you use your energies better with the time that you have. You can't actually physically manage time. Time just keeps going. We can't control time itself. Verse 15. Whatever is has already been. What will be has been before. The cycle just keeps on going. And the right response to living in a world under judgment, under the tyranny of time, is to know our place, not as those who control time, but as those who fear the one who does. And knowing our place and fearing him will mean, one, that we must not ignore that sense of eternity within our hearts. We must not ignore that sense of eternity within our hearts. Very, very few actually believe there is nothing when we die. And often, even those who have spent a lifetime denying that there is nothing when we die, often shortly before their own deaths, begin to hope and want something. And the reason is because God has placed eternity in our hearts. We were made for more. And the more, the Bible says elsewhere, is to be with Jesus in the new heavens and the new earth, which is this earth renewed and made perfect for all eternity. We're not floating around as some kind of spiritual beings with wings, but living in this world renewed with Christ. Working, playing, worshipping. That's what we've been made for. So don't deny that sense of eternity. Allow that sense of frustration and angst that you feel to make you think of something more, which the Bible says is only found in Jesus. So will you, in your frustration, in your angst, seek to find him and discover more? We're going to speak a little bit more later on this morning about what it means to know Jesus and find him. But will you allow that sense of frustration to prompt you, to urge you to begin to seek answers to what that more is, to why eternity has been placed in your heart? Do not ignore that sense of eternity. But secondly, knowing our place will mean trusting God's sovereignty with time. Knowing our place will mean trusting God's sovereignty with time. That is that his timings are perfect. That is that he allows things at certain times for our good and for his glory. Romans 8 makes that very clear, doesn't it? And yet so often, we're trying to change that timing. We're trying to rework it and seeking to control all we can to make things work out in our time and in our structures. But God knows best. He's in control. He's the only one who can see the beginning to the end, which is why he's the best person to trust with the timings. The one who sees it all, the one who understands it all, the one who allows things and denies things. So trust him with the timings of marriage, of children, of particular circumstances, of illness. Now, that doesn't mean we just sit back and do nothing. We're going to seek great medical care where we can. And of course, we're going to try for children, and we're going to seek out wives or husbands if that's right. But I do so humbly. I do so looking for his wisdom to know what to do, and when things don't work out, I trust his timings. So I don't get frustrated and I don't get angry that it's not quite happened in this year when I wanted it. I wanted to be married by the time I was 40. I wanted to have children by the time I was 38. But I wanted this and that, and it's just not worked out. And I need to trust him with his timing. Or when I get ill, when I get setbacks and it doesn't quite work as I want it to work, and I haven't quite got better as quick as I'd like to. Or the treatment hasn't quite come up as quickly as I'd want it to. And yeah, of course it's right, we need to push these things, but I've also got to trust. Trust his timings. Trust that he knows best. We're not in control. He is. Secondly, knowing our place will mean knowing that God is in charge of judgment, not you. God's in charge of judgment and creation, not you. So you have a look at verse 16. Solomon observes that in this fallen world, under judgment, justice is upside down. Things are not quite right. So verse 16, in the place of judgment, wickedness. In the place of justice, wickedness. In other words, the innocent were punished. The guilty let off. And we observe that corruption and judges bribed and people let off and the rich buy themselves out and find the loopholes and the poor and imprisoned. We know these things happen. It's the world we live in. But Solomon also knows, taking the principle he spoke of in verses 1 to 9 and he applies it to this issue, if there is a season for everything, and a time for every matter under heaven, 3 verse 1, then there must be a time for justice. Verse 17, God will bring into judgment both the righteous and the wicked. For there will be a time for every activity, a time to judge every deed. And it might seem from verses 1 to 15 that the word is just going around in never-ending cyclical nature. It might feel it, but here we learn it's not. In fact, time is linear. It's heading for a day of judgment where wrongs will be righted and injustices made just. Which means for us now, knowing our place. Knowing our place, that God's in charge of judgment, not me. And so often this works out in our lives, isn't it? That someone hurts us or something goes wrong, and we just can't let it go. We want to seek revenge and we want to seek to get justice for that hurt. We want to do what we can to make it right. And we pour all our energy into it. I've just been reading the book, The Reverend, by a guy called Michael Punk. It's been made into a film. And The premise of the story, and I didn't realize until I finished it, but it's a true story. It's a guy called Hugh Glass is the main character. And what happens is he's a trapper. He's seeking beaver fur to make money. It's part of the kind of going out west in the US in the 1800s. And he's out seeking and hunting, and he gets attacked by a bear. And he's left for dead. He's in a pretty bad way. I won't go into all the details, but it's pretty gory. But all his friends expect him to die. But he just keeps hanging on. And so after a time, the group decided they've got to move on, and they leave two behind with him who will just stay with him to bury him, to make sure he has a good burial. And after a couple of days, he's still not dead. And suddenly the Indians come, and he's a little bit, they're scared. And so they flee. And before they flee, they rob him of everything he has, his gun, his knife, all these expensive items, and thinking he's going to die. But he doesn't. He survives. And it's a great story of how he literally on his knees, he crawls and gets better and he finally gets strong enough. But it's all about him seeking to get revenge on those two guys who left him. Not because they left him, but because they robbed him before they left him. And he goes back after them. And he spends his whole life, the next how many years, seeking revenge. He's just consumed by it. And in the end, he doesn't get the revenge he wants. And he has to make peace with that. And yet so often we can be just like that. Our whole lives focus on getting revenge and getting unjustice on what we feel we've been slighted or we've been felt embittered by something. And knowing our place will mean actually, no, we're going to trust God with the justice, with the judgment, that he'll right the wrongs and he'll bring justice to the unjust. Knowing our place is knowing that God's in charge of judgment, not me. And of course, Romans 13 speaks that, doesn't it, of where he says just that, leave it to me. And yet so often we want to hold on to it. And what happens is we become embittered and hurt and consumed. But knowing our place means we'll trust God with judgment. And rather than simply getting sad and angry about the oppression we see in the world, we can trust God to make things right in the end and trusting his timings. Now, again, it doesn't mean we don't pursue justice now. We have roles to play in our homes, in our spheres of influence, and where we can, we should fight injustice and wrongs. But we know as well that despite our best efforts, we'll never bring an end to all the oppression or injustice in our world. There will sadly still be violence against women and children. There still will be structures of corruption in business and government. There will still be, as we read this week, or Ros read to me this week, little boys who die in certain parts of the world because they cannot get the right milk for their lactose intolerance. Whilst other little boys, like my little boy, lives in a part of the world where he can get such things simply by walking down the road. But in all those situations that we cannot resolve, God will see to it that justice will be done. And we read in Acts 17, verse 30, that God has not only promised such a day, but he's guaranteed it. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day where he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. See, we live in the sure hope and expectation of that great day, that whenever we see injustice or oppression, we can pray for justice and we can leave things in God's hands. And this requires faith in God's promises and patience to wait for his timings. See, we're not in control of time. And I'm not the judge. He is. So know your place. Know your place. Justice will come. Jesus' death and resurrection is the proof. Now, some people still wonder, well, why is justice delayed? Why doesn't God judge people right away? Why does he wait? And Solomon has the answer, verse 18. God's in charge of creation, not me. I also said to myself, Solomon writes, verse 18, as for humans, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Now, our present existence is a test, not simply in something we pass or fail, but in the sense of something that demonstrates our true character. the word test here in the Hebrew has as its root this idea of purifying and testing what we truly fear and who we live for. And the test is not for God's benefit, but to help us know our place. To know our place before God, our Creator, both now and for that day of judgment. And at first, Solomon's comparison to animals seems unbiblical. I mean, Genesis 1 makes clear that we are different from the animals. We're above them. We're made in the image of God. And of course, all that is true. But the point here is to underline not our biology, but our destiny. See verse 19? Surely our fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything is meaningless. All go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all return. Death is the great equalizer for all the differences between us and animals, between me and my dog. We both die. And we may be more intelligent, we may be more technologically advanced. I'm certainly more technically advanced than my dog. Intelligence is give and take on certain days. But when it comes to death, we're the same. Life will not last forever. To dust we return. And in using this language, Solomon is reminding us of God's curse against Adam's sin. You remember Genesis 3:19, dust we are. And to dust we shall return. Part of living under the sun, under judgment, is that we all die. We're to know our place. We're the created, not the creator. And because of that, it seems and feels, says Solomon, as if it's all meaningless, verse 19. Everything is meaningless. It's futile. Life is brief. And then we die. And worse than that, he says, verse 21, who knows if the human spirit rises upward and the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth? As those who are created, we can do nothing about what happens next. All we can do, says Solomon, is accept our lot and act as those who are created. See, verse 22, there is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work because that is their lot. We work, we die. And there is nothing we can do about what will happen after us. See verse 22. For who can bring them to see what will happen after them? We cannot fathom on our own what happens next. And we live with these various tensions. We live with the burden of time and the hamster wheel. And we have a sense of eternity and yet we long for justice. And yet we know we die like the animals. We hope for something more. But who knows? Who knows? Jesus. Jesus knows. The answer has come. Solomon had an inkling of it. He doesn't say it here in Ecclesiastes 3, but if you get to Ecclesiastes 12, he speaks of remembering our Creator, and he speaks of the spirit of humans going up to be with their Creator, but he doesn't have the full picture. But this side of the cross we do. Jesus has come. And now anyone who wants to know what will happen after death should ask Jesus. And anyone who wants to know what happens in eternity should ask Jesus. And anyone who wants to know about judgment should ask Jesus. Because he is able to bring us to see what will be after us. Because he's been through death and he's reached the other side. And Jesus was put to death on a cross. But he did not stay dead. On the third day, he rose again. His body and spirit ascended to the glory at the right hand of God. Jesus knows. And the point of Ecclesiastes 3, of this wrestle of eternity, this longing for justice, this test, the reality of death, is that we might know our place and fear God. And what is it to fear God this side of the cross? It's to ask Jesus. It's to recognize our position and turn and worship him. Remember I said earlier, for those kind of that longing of eternity, we're not to ignore that sense. Here's the point. Here's how we get that understanding through Jesus. Through trusting his death to pay our punishment for our rebellion against our Creator. And if we do, at that point I am then forgiven. No longer do I face his judgment as a condemned man. I still have to give an account of my use of time, but I have nothing to fear. And now I do know where I'm going. I do know where I will be for eternity. But not because of anything I have done. And I still live in this world that's under judgment. I'm still caught up in the hamster wheel of life. But now because of Jesus, we can begin to fathom that which we and Solomon once couldn't. Now we've been allowed to see more of the tapestry, more of the big picture, and live in light of it. And as one who fears God, I give God his rights to order all things in this world as he sees fit. That he's under no obligation to reveal to me the reasons why incomprehensible and often incredibly painful events happen in my life. He is the creator. He is the one who controls time, not me. Life under judgment, life under the sun will mean I won't fathom it all. I won't understand all that happens to me, in particular the difficult seasons. Life is still frustrating and hard. That's life under the sun. But as one who fears God, I know where the world is heading. That is not cyclical as I once thought. And I look forward to the eternity that is set in my heart and that once confused me. And I trust his purposes. And for the non-believer, the frustration of not even beginning to fathom things will continue to humble them until the day when they will be completely humbled and every knee will bow either willingly by turning to Jesus now or then in fear and trembling. So turn now before it's too late. Life under the sun is life under God's judgment. Recognize it and know your place. Let's pause. Watch the band come up. Take a moment just to reflect on your place. Where are you before God? Are you a believer who is recognizing that God is in control of time, that he's the creator, he's the judge? But are there areas of your life where, hey, you're seeking to control time? Where you're seeking to judge and hold revenge against someone in bitterness? Are there areas where you need to recognize he's the creator? He gives and he takes away. Maybe you're not a believer here this morning. And you're sensing that sense of eternity within your heart. Don't leave here this morning without talking with someone about that. Don't leave here this morning if you're beginning to sense, yep, I know there's something more and I want to know it. How do I go about it? Come and talk to me. Come and talk to someone you know who is a Christian. We'd love to tell you more about how to unwrestle that sense of frustration. Take a moment to think where you are and know your place.